From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the world observes the 10th anniversary of a deadly tsunami. Three nations agree to share intelligence about North Korea. Talks in Belarus on the Ukraine crisis break down. Wildlife experts try to save a rare breed of rhinoceros in Kenya. All these stories and more just ahead on International Edition. I'm Dave DeForest. Memorial services were held today in Asia to mark the 10th anniversary of the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami. The 2004 tsunami, triggered by a 9.3 magnitude earthquake off the western Indonesia coast, killed more than 220,000 people, affected 14 countries, displaced millions of people, and caused billions of dollars in damage. There were no warning systems in place at that time and not enough time for people to find higher ground before the towering waves hit coastlines as far away as Africa. It took just 20 minutes after the quake for the first waves, some more than 35 meters high, to hit the coast of Aceh. Eric Geist, a research geophysicist with the U.S. Geological Survey based in Menlo Park, California, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the scope of the disaster was unprecedented in recorded history.
A major magnitude 9 earthquake had not occurred in the Indian Ocean in recent history. And of course, in recent years, the population density of people living near the coast all over the world, but especially in that part of the world, has increased tremendously. So the conditions were right for such a disaster to happen. But I don't believe any geoscientists foresaw a magnitude 9 occurring in that part of the world.
What was the key thing that caused so much damage and loss of life?
Primarily, the population density living at very low elevations near the coast. That and the lack, at that time, of a tsunami warning system. So there was virtually no warning to most of the people, other than the natural warning of ground shaking or the ocean receding before the strong waves came ashore.
How likely is such an event to recur?
It might not occur for a long time in that same area, but there are other parts of the fault zone and other fault zones in the Indian Ocean that might sustain a earthquake of that size and perhaps even a tsunami of that size.
Has anything changed? Have any lessons been learned to protect against future such catastrophes?
Yes, the tsunami warning systems around the world have changed tremendously in the last 10 years. In particular, in the Indian Ocean, we now have these deep ocean pressure gauges that are very good at detecting tsunamis. India and Thailand both have these deep ocean gauges. In addition, three countries, India, Indonesia, and Australia, have developed their own regional warning systems. So the state of tsunami warning in the Indian Ocean has vastly improved in the last 10 years.
Will these warning systems be enough to warn people who still live near the coastline?
The trick is in getting the warning out in time for locations very close to the earthquake. That's when the tsunami may only take 15 minutes to come ashore. That's a very short amount of time. In general, we have the technology to get a warning out within a few minutes. The hard part is the last mile problem, where the emergency managers have to get that information out to the public that's living very near the coast. And that's often the most difficult situation, as well as getting those people evacuated.
While Geist says the Asia-Pacific region could experience a similar-sized earthquake and tsunami in the next 100 years, he says a recurrence in or near the same location is unlikely because of the so-called mean return time for such an event is a very long period, perhaps 1,000 years or longer. Martin Mulligan, Associate Professor of Global, Urban, and Social Studies at Australia's RMIT University, was visiting Sri Lanka at the time of the tsunami and later became Chief Investigator for AusAid on the lessons from post-recovery efforts in Sri Lanka. He says the country was ill-prepared for the disaster, which claimed 30,000 lives.
The waves reached Sri Lanka pretty much on the other side of the Indian Ocean, still up to 14 meters in height. There wasn't any land between. But Sri Lanka had never had a tsunami in record. There's in legend a mention of events about 2,000 years ago. So this was something that was not anywhere on the radar. In fact, they didn't even know what the word tsunami meant. So whereas Indonesia, Japan may have experienced tsunamis in the past, this particular one reached parts of the world far from the epicenter, which had no inkling that they were vulnerable to tsunami. So when the waves were approaching, the sea retreated for a while. So a lot of people went down to look at it. So there needs to be an ongoing education campaign about the fact that we are more vulnerable than we think. And so you don't have to go very far inland to escape the worst of a tsunami. It really only affects the first 1 or 2 kilometres into the inland. So the people who did survive were able to get to high land away from the devastating impact. But there have been a few attempts to have local community warning systems, but they haven't been very effective. People's mobile phones could become a major way of warning people, because even in countries like Sri Lanka, almost everybody has a mobile phone. So it wouldn't be that hard to send out warnings, and that would definitely save lives. May not do a lot to save property and houses, so 500,000 people in Sri Lanka were made homeless, so maybe there's not a lot you can do about that. But you certainly would have saved a lot of lives.
10 years on, has the rebuilding been complete following this terrible devastation?
Kind of, but quite a lot of mistakes were made, and that's the lessons we need to learn. The relief effort was better than expected. People did manage to get the roads going, bridges back. The railway line was reconstructed within months, which was very unexpected. Health issues, water, so all that sort of stuff, those kind of physical challenges were dealt with rather well. There were a lot of people came, a lot of volunteers. Sri Lankans really rose to the occasion and put in a lot of volunteer work. So all of that stuff was done well. But then, of course, the problems that have emerged are that things were then rushed in terms of relocating people, their social needs, and therefore you set up problems which are still lingering problems. A bad legacy of haste. The biggest problem with social recovery is that haste becomes the enemy. So whereas with relief work, you want it done with speed and efficiency, well, as soon as you start to think about where people will live for the rest of their lives, perhaps, you've got to slow down and make sure the aid money is not rushed, that you don't waste it, you don't duplicate, that needs are properly assessed, that you think very carefully about where people might be living when you relocate them. And there's been some big mistakes. So there are now post-tsunami settlements built with aid money which have been abandoned. They just didn't work for people, so that was obviously a great waste. And there's quite a lot of dissatisfaction about where people are now located and the communities they're now living in compared to before. So these are long-enduring problems. If you put people into a worse situation socially, where livelihoods are even harder to find, for example, then you've got long-term social consequences.
In Indonesia's Aceh province, located on the northern tip of Sumatra Island and the closest populated area to the earthquake, wider roads have been built to facilitate future coastal evacuations. Houses and shops have been constructed further away from the coastline, and multi-story buildings are now serving as emergency shelters. A group monitoring the conflict in Syria says government airstrikes have killed more than 24 civilians in an area controlled by Islamic State fighters. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the attacks were on Al-Bab and the nearby town of Qabasin. Pakistani intelligence officials say suspected U.S. drone strikes have killed a number of militants. The strikes today targeted compounds of Taliban and Uzbek militants in Pakistan's remote North Waziristan region. They come as Pakistan ramps up its anti-terrorism strategy in the wake of a December 16th Taliban attack on an army-run school in Peshawar. Nearly 150 people were killed in that attack, most of them children. Also today, officials said security forces had killed the alleged planner of the Peshawar school attack. The head of the police in the Khyber tribal region said security forces fought a gun battle with a militant commander known as Saddam and his accomplices. Saddam was killed in the 4-hour shootout, while his 6 accomplices were wounded and arrested. They are being interrogated. South Korean officials say their government and the governments of the U.S. and Japan have agreed on a trilateral intelligence sharing pact to deal with North Korea's missile and nuclear programs. Officials said today the agreement would enable the three allies to quickly respond to any North Korean provocation. It would apply to intelligence sharing only on the North's missile and nuclear progress. South Korean officials say the formal signing of the pact by the South Korean Vice Defense Minister and his U.S. and Japanese counterparts will take place on Monday. Last month, the U.S. Korea Institute at Johns Hopkins University said prototype ballistic missiles seen at recent North Korean military parades may be more advanced than earlier believed and may even be sophisticated enough to threaten the U.S. West Coast. Many Western analysts had dismissed the KN-08 missiles as primitive, non-operational mock-ups when they first appeared in photos at Pyongyang military parades in April 2012 and again in July of this year. This is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington.
Do you love music from Africa and the world? VOA has the latest hits, interviews with the artists, and we are glad to take your requests. The Voice of America has what you're looking for. We have music shows to please everyone. Join us on the radio or on the internet to listen day or night. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on your favorite program. Just follow your ears. Music from Africa and the world. We've got it on VOA.
Ukrainian officials and pro-Russian rebels will not be meeting today in Belarus's capital Minsk for a round of peace talks as originally planned. Belarusian officials today announced the breakdown of the negotiations. It's not clear if the talks will resume at a later date. Talks between Ukrainian government negotiators and their pro-Russian separatist counterparts have failed to produce any breakthrough to end the 8-month conflict in eastern Ukraine. Russian preparations for the New Year holiday are clouded by economic recession and a tumbling currency, the ruble. Nonetheless, people in the Russian capital appear to be in a festive mood. Daniel Scharf reports.
Despite economic worries, Moscow's residents and visitors are flocking to Christmas fairs to enjoy seasonal snacks and amusements. But a fiscal freeze is descending. Falling oil prices and Western sanctions have undermined the ruble, driving up prices for imported goods and pushing Russia toward a recession. President Vladimir Putin says the economic contraction will last a couple of years at most, but that is little comfort to many Russians, including shopper Soso.
I'm trying not to think about it. It's very bad. We'll see how it develops. It's a nightmare.
More Russians will be enjoying winter activities this season since they cannot afford to travel abroad. Some take a pragmatic view of holiday business, like roasted chestnuts vendor Galina.
It seems to me that those who have money aren't going to economize on chestnuts, right? Maybe the old people, the pensioners, or people with small salaries. But people who have money, they'll always have money.
Holiday shoppers may be changing their spending habits, but they are still buying, says Maria, who sells knitted gifts.
In connection with our economic problems, people, of course, are choosing less expensive and more practical items. But our goods are very marketable, so people are buying them as gifts despite their money problems.
As Russia prepares to ring in a wallet-tightening new year, Grandfather Frost, the Slavic Santa Claus, gives some holiday words of advice.
I'm neither wizard nor warlock nor soothsayer. I'm simply a New Year's winter magician. Your New Year's depends on you. However you want it to be, however you celebrate it, whatever your New Year's wishes will be that night, that's how the next year will be. Everything depends on you. So if you have the desire for a better life, then that's how things will turn out.
Despite the holiday magic, less optimistic voices say the Kremlin's failure to diversify the economy and its continued actions in Ukraine threaten to plunge the country into a full-fledged economic crisis. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Moscow.
Wildlife conservationists in Kenya are scrambling to save a rare species of rhinoceros that has been hunted and poached to the brink of extinction. VOA's Gabe Josselow reports.
The northern white rhino that once roamed a territory stretching from Uganda through the Democratic Republic of Congo and as far north as Chad could disappear within our lifetimes. The Old Pajeta Conservancy in central Kenya is home to three of these animals. Under the watch of armed guards, they meander easily across a natural expanse of grass and shrubs and rub and play and eat with groups of southern white rhinos, their close genetic cousins. Mohamed Doyo has been caretaker to these animals since they arrived at the conservatory in 2009.
The one I'm touching here, she is called Najin, or you can call her Nai. Nai is 25 years old. Her daughter, she is 13 years old, and she is the last one born in the zoo. The other one is Sudan, the only male left in the world.
The rhinos came to Kenya from a zoo in the Czech Republic with the hope that the species would thrive in a more natural habitat. But that optimism has not been met with breeding success, and the population is dwindling fast. One of the rhinos here, Suni, unexpectedly died in October. A zoo in the U.S. city of San Diego lost another in mid-December. San Diego still has one left, as does the zoo in the Czech Republic. But the last wild population in the Democratic Republic of Congo was hunted and killed during armed conflicts in the last decade. Killings of all types of rhinos across Africa have been driven by Asian demand due to the mistaken belief that the horns have medicinal properties. Doyo files down the rhino's horns at Old Pajeta to make them less enticing to poachers. He also had a chance to lobby on behalf of the rhinos to a visiting Chinese basketball legend.
There was a guy here by the name Yao Ming. He was doing a documentary telling the China people should stop believing the horn of a rhino as a medicine. Instead of that, I told him they should use their fingernails or hair because it's one material.
Sudan, the last male of the species, is 41 years old, and his past attempts at mating were unsuccessful. So now conservationists will try to artificially impregnate a young, fertile female. If that does not work, they will try in vitro fertilization, possibly using a southern white rhino as a kind of surrogate mother. The last solution would be crossbreeding between the two species, which are physically and genetically similar. This is Richard Vine, CEO of Old Pajeta.
It's about preserving those genetic traits which confer upon the northern white as a species or a subspecies, whatever you want to call it, the ability to live in Central Africa with all of the disease and habitat challenges that that presents. Those genetic traits could be preserved as part of a hybrid with a southern white. But as long as they're there, then one day, hopefully, maybe in 100 years' time, we'll be able to reintroduce rhinos into that part of Africa.
The fact of the matter is the northern white rhino gene pool has been depleted to the point that preserving the animal as a unique species is quite a long shot. But Vine says this effort is not just about saving one type of rhino.
We're keen to make the point that, you know, if human beings continue to treat the planet in the way that they're treating it, this isn't going to be the only major mammalian species which goes extinct in the next few years. That's going to happen more and more and more.
Vine says the process is expected to get underway in January with the assistance of experts from the Czech zoo where they came from. The good news is that southern white rhino populations have rebounded in the last century since being pushed to the brink of extinction themselves. If crossbreeding is successful, then there is hope that some trace of the otherwise doomed northern white species may still live on. Gabe Josselow, VOA News, Kenya.
Turkish authorities have released a teenage boy who was arrested for allegedly insulting President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The 16-year-old was embraced by his mother today as he walked out of a detention center in the central city of Konya. At a student protest on Wednesday, the boy gave a speech accusing President Erdogan of corruption. The case prompted an outcry from lawyers. Although the boy was released at the order of the court, he still faces up to 4 years in prison if he is charged and convicted. Well, that's it for this edition of International Edition here on VOA. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day at our website. Why not check it out? You can find it at voanews.com. Sitting in again for Susan Yockey today, I'm Dave DeForest in Washington. Have a good day. This is Today in History. On December 26, 2004, an earthquake off the Sumatran coast of Indonesia triggered a series of devastating tsunamis that spread across the Indian Ocean. The waves inundated coastal communities in parts of Indonesia, Sri Lanka, India, Thailand, and as far away as Africa. Estimates have put the worldwide death toll at more than 200,000, making the catastrophe one of the deadliest disasters in modern history. On this day in 1991, the Supreme Soviet of the Soviet Union met to formally dissolve the Soviet Union. In 1825, reformist Russian army officers and soldiers protested against the new Tsar Nicholas I. The Decembrist revolt was quickly put down by forces loyal to Nicholas. Several rebels were executed, others were exiled to Siberia. On this day in 1898, the discovery of the highly radioactive chemical element known as radium was announced by Marie Curie and her husband Pierre. Madame Curie was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics for the discovery. She is the only person to have received two Nobel Prizes. The other was in chemistry. On this day in 1963, Capitol Records released the Beatles' I Want to Hold Your Hand in the United States.
Oh, yeah. I think you'll understand when I say that something. I want to hold your hand.
The record, which had been released in Britain the month before, reached number one in the U.S. 5 weeks later. 1 year later, on this day in 1964, the Beatles celebrated their sixth number one single in a year when I Feel Fine topped the charts. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has imposed tighter economic restrictions on the Crimean Peninsula following Russia's occupation and purported annexation earlier this year. President Barack Obama joined Europe in maintaining pressure on Russia with the announcement of additional sanctions on separatist leaders in Crimea and eastern Ukraine, the Night Wolves motorcycle gang, and other entities that have supported the separatists. Specifically, President Obama signed an executive order barring new investment and trade with Crimea and freezing the property of people or businesses found to be operating in the region or helping the so-called leadership. The U.S. also targeted 24 individuals and entities involved in the pro-Russia uprising in Crimea and eastern Ukraine, barring their entry into the United States and freezing any assets that are subject to U.S. jurisdiction. The executive order, said President Obama in a written statement, is intended to provide clarity to U.S. corporations doing business in the region and reaffirm that the United States will not accept Russia's occupation and purported annexation of Crimea. Russia's economy is already reeling from capital flight and a depreciating currency, fueled in part by falling oil prices, economic mismanagement, coordinated Western sanctions, and economic isolation brought about by its military interference in Ukraine. The United States again calls on Russia to end its occupation and attempted annexation of Crimea, cease its support to separatists in eastern Ukraine, and fulfill its commitments under the Minsk agreements. The United States will continue to work closely with allies and partners in Europe and internationally to respond to events in Ukraine and to support Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity, as well as its democratic development reform efforts. Whether sanctions are eventually removed or additional sanctions are imposed is entirely dependent on Russia's actions in Ukraine, including Crimea.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials. Thank you.